It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. The FDA wants to ban two tobacco products that have disproportionately hurt African Americans, menthol cigarettes and flavored cigars. Coming up, our guest says it's about time. First, a bill that would remove the gray wolf from the endangered species list is headed to the U.S. Senate. It passed the House on Friday. The bill is authored by Republican Congressman Sean Duffy of Wausau. He spoke on the House floor before the vote.
You can make the argument that the pretty little puppy of the wolf, it's so pretty and beautiful, and we have to protect it. Well, we did protect it. We put it on the endangered species list. And like a lot of government programs, this one worked. And we have protected them and allowed them to recover.
Wisconsin's wolf population had been steadily increasing for decades, but in June, state wildlife officials estimated the number of wolves to be in the lower 900s, a slight decline from the previous year. The state DNR added that it might take a couple of years before we know for sure whether the population has stabilized. Supporters of the bill in Congress say wolves kill livestock and pets and pose other problems. Opponents say those issues are overstated and that the wolf needs to remain protected. Timothy Kama covers energy and the environment for The Hill. Tim, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, give us the basics. What exactly would this bill do if it were ultimately passed?
So what this bill would do is it would instruct the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to remove the gray wolf from the endangered species or threatened species list in the entire lower 48 states. But it would also make it so that any opponents of that delisting could not sue in court to have that delisting overturned if they felt that that was improper.
And that's a big point, because there's been a long process here with efforts to take the gray wolf off the endangered species list and those efforts being thwarted by lawsuits, right?
Exactly. This has been attempted before, and in those cases, the federal courts said that that was improper. Even under the Obama administration, they made the scientific determination that that these protections were no longer warranted. But then the court system stepped in and said that was improper. Now the Trump administration is expected as soon as next month to propose once again to delist the gray wolf. That, of course, would then have to be finalized and could also go back to court if this particular bill doesn't pass.
What was the partisan breakdown on this vote to approve this plan to delist the gray wolf?
So this was almost entirely Republican support in the House that passed it. However, there were some Democrats who joined in to support it frequently, Democrats in Minnesota or other states where they have a lot of gray wolf population and a lot of, ranchers or residents or what have you who think that this is a pest and a predator that they don't want around and don't want protected.
If this ultimately passes, does this mean it goes to states where the gray wolf lives to figure out their own management strategy?
Exactly. If this were to pass, which, by the way, would still require the Senate to approve legislation like this, and then President Trump would have to sign it, then states would be able to institute their own protections for this if they wanted to. But the default status in every state would be that it is not protected, and hunters could kill them, ranchers could kill them, or what have you.
Talking to Timothy Kama, he covers energy and the environment for The Hill, looking at a bill that passed in the U.S. House, still waiting for the U.S. Senate now, that would take the gray wolf off the endangered species list. Tim, let's get into the pro-con side of this. These are arguments we've heard, I'll tell you, a lot here in Wisconsin. But for Congressman Duffy and other supporters, what were some of the main points they made in saying, hey, it's time to take the gray wolf off the list?
Right. So for the supporters of this legislation, what this really centered on was their view that the gray wolf is more an unnecessary predator and pest than anything valuable to an ecosystem. This species has been protected since the 1970s. There's some disagreement over whether that was necessary at the time, because at that time it had been decades of human activity, pushing them out of their habitats, killing them to protect livestock and pets and humans and things like that. So that protection was intended to sort of bring them back from the brink of extinction when there were only a few hundred left in the wild. But the supporters of this bill, such as Congressman Duffy, feel that protection has been too successful, that these wolves are now coming back to being past the predator, and that states, that landowners, that individuals should be able to either harm them or kill them or what have you as needed to protect their interests, be that their livestock, individuals, pets, things of that nature, and that the only way to do that, of course, is to remove federal protections.
And what was the argument on the other side against passing this bill?
So the argument on the other side is that, ecologically, biologically, these wolves are necessary to a lot of ecosystems. The Democrats, for example, who were speaking out against this bill, they kept bringing up this example of in Yellowstone National Park years ago when wolves were reintroduced to the park by humans, by scientists. It really had a big impact on the ecology of the entire park, down to the trees, the rivers, things like that, to really bring it back to the way it was before humans started killing off a lot of the wolves. The argument is that you have all these animals, these plants that really, when you don't have one strong predator kind of at the top of the food system to keep things in check, that things don't operate as well as they could.
As you mentioned, this would have to pass in the U.S. Senate now. This is a lame duck session. Is there any indication that the U.S. Senate is going to jump on this right away?
Right. So it's a possibility. There's at least one piece of legislation working its way through the Senate that has a provision in it that would remove the gray wolf from the endangered species list. It's sort of a wide-ranging wildlife bill that would do. It's bipartisan, so it would do, some good things for wildlife as well. That has passed through the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, so it's awaiting consideration on the Senate floor if the Senate decides to take it up. The Senate and the House are both considering passing some sort of wide-ranging public lands legislation during the lame duck session. It's something that they do a lot of years to, things like national parks or forests or what have you. This is something that could possibly be included in legislation like that as a compromise for something else. That's probably one of its most likely paths to passage. Of course, that would be a negotiation with the Democrats, and they might either not let that happen or try to get some other thing in return for that. But that's probably its most likely path if it's going to get passed anytime soon.
We'll leave it there, Tim. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me on that.
That's Timothy Kama. He covers energy and the environment for The Hill. We talked to him about Wisconsin Congressman Sean Duffy's bill that would delist the gray wolf from the endangered species list. That bill passed the House on Friday and now theoretically heads to the Senate. Coming up, if the FDA gets its way, you won't be able to buy menthol tobacco products anymore. We'll look at the agency's latest proposal coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at why the U.S. lags behind many other countries in recycling and why our guest says that's bad news for the environment and for the American economy. First, the Food and Drug Administration is proposing the most drastic action against the tobacco industry in a decade or so, an outright ban on menthol cigarettes and flavored cigars. Both kinds of products have disproportionately harmed African Americans. Black leaders have accused tobacco companies of intentionally marketing to African Americans, especially African American women. But the makers of Marlboro Menthol said in a statement that banning menthol cigarettes or flavored cigars is an extreme measure not supported by science or evidence. The proposed ban doesn't cover flavored e-cigarettes, which the FDA had been threatening in an effort to reduce vaping by minors. The agency is calling, though, for stores to only sell them from closed-off areas inaccessible to teens. Del Monte Jefferson is the executive director of the National African American Tobacco Prevention Network. Del Monte, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Now, why are these menthol cigarettes, menthol tobacco products, such a concern for African American health in the United States?
Well, mainly because African Americans that smoke, predominantly smoke menthol flavored tobacco products. I think the last numbers we have us that smoking menthol is at 88%. And that's an incredibly large number. And so banning menthol would definitely improve African-American health and save lives.
What's some of the history behind that? Was this a product that was especially marketed or targeted to African-American communities?
Yeah, it's been targeted to African-American communities as well as other priority populations as well. The tobacco industry is very savvy. They're very smart. They know that menthol masks the harshness of tobacco. And so menthol was put in cigarettes at certain levels to make it easier to smoke. When the tobacco industry decided that it wanted a certain population to smoke, they would then intentionally go to those communities and offer free cigarettes, sponsor different events, bribe politicians, offer money to different churches, civic organizations, and even colleges and universities to get them to be silent as they continue.
Cut out there for a moment, Amont. Do we have you now?
Yes, I'm here.
And our flavored products, whether we're talking about a menthol cigarettes or sweetened cigars or now these flavored e-cigarettes, are these kind of a gateway to tobacco for younger smokers in particular?
Yeah, for younger smokers, again, anyone that the tobacco industry wants to start smoking, they're going to put some type of flavor, menthol or flavor, to attract them to the product. The menthol attracts them. The nicotine addicts them.
Now, we've heard, as I mentioned, some tobacco companies saying, okay, the harm of smoking a menthol cigarette isn't any greater than the harm of smoking a non-menthol cigarette, so it's unfair to regulate them differently. What would you say to that argument?
Well, very simply, African Americans actually smoke less cigarettes than other populations. They smoke less. However, they die more rapidly of diseases that are tobacco-related. Well, that's because when they do smoke menthol, because it's so easy, because it's so smooth and soothing going down, they tend to smoke more. They tend to inhale more. So smoking menthol products makes it more harmful to you, and it makes it harder to quit.
Can you talk about the health impact of tobacco among African Americans in the United States? How big is the problem?
46,000 African-Americans die every year from tobacco-related diseases, and that's a huge, huge problem. So if we're trying to save lives, and we know that we're smoking mentholated tobacco products, one of the ways that we can save lives, to save some of those lives, is by this ban.
Now, the FDA is suggesting this ban. It's not a done deal. It would require various stages of approval. Probably it would face lawsuits. Do you think that ultimately this is something that could happen, this ban?
Well, to be quite frank, back in 2009, when the Family Smoking and Tobacco Prevention Act was passed, we advocated then, don't exclude menthol. Please include menthol in this. Don't leave menthol out. Well, they didn't listen to us. Now, for whatever reasons it was, they still went on with this this Tobacco Act. They left menthol out, and we advocated ever since to include it. Now, when we saw that there was going to be no movement, what the advocates did was we started at a different angle. We started advocating for local menthol sales restrictions. Since we knew that localities couldn't ban menthol, localities could restrict the sale of menthol. So that's happening right now across the country at a community level. That's going to continue happening. So the FDA, we applaud them for their decision, and we hope that they're able to get this passed. But even if they can't, we're going to continue action at the local level to restrict the sale of menthol community by community by community.
How has that worked at the local community level? What kind of restrictions have communities passed on the sale of menthol cigarettes?
It started in Chicago back in 2013. Chicago started with a 500-foot buffer zone around the public schools, and they passed that. And so they couldn't sell mentholated flavored cigarettes between a 500-foot buffer zone of any school around in Chicago. So that was the first ever restriction on the sale of menthol. Well, since then, you had municipalities like Minneapolis, Minnesota, and Duluth, Minnesota, that passed a restriction saying you could only sell mentholated tobacco products in adult-only stores. Now, that was a success, and that was a gradual success from having the 500-foot buffer zone. But now we have places in California that are having citywide bans on the sale of menthol cigarettes. Started in San Francisco. The tobacco industry came out against it in full force. However, the voters in San Francisco overwhelmingly supported that ban. And so it became the first city to enact a citywide ban, and other cities in California have followed suit.
One question I might have is, okay, if menthol cigarettes are banned in a city, does everyone just move to non-mentholated cigarettes, or does it lead to an overall decline in the number of people who smoke, or maybe the number of youth who start smoking in the first place?
Well, it's definitely going to lead to all of those things that you just said. Now, studies have been taken and have shown, African Americans have said, hey, look, if you ban menthol, then I'm going to just quit smoking. I've wanted to quit anyway, and if menthol were banned, this would be my opportunity to quit. Now, of course, this was a study, and this is what people have said. We know that nicotine is a powerful, powerful addiction. And so we hope that that's the case, but this is what folks have said. But the mere fact that youth, our young people, are banned from having access to those products means that youth aren't going to start initiation.
Talking to Del Monte Jefferson with the National African American Tobacco Prevention Network about this call from the FDA to, among other things, ban menthol cigarettes. This also covers flavored vaping products, not a ban, but actually similar to what you said about what some communities did with menthol, saying, okay, you can sell flavored vaping products. They have to be in a separate room or in an 18 and up store. Is this an issue you're tracking? And if so, what do you think of this idea from the FDA?
I think the exact same thing when they had the ban originally on flavored cigarettes and they excluded menthol. The exact same scenario plays out. Do not exclude menthol or flavored e-cigarette juices and the like. You must also include them in your sales restrictions. I know that some folks have said, adults have said, that they've used them as cessation aids. However, the fact that you're keeping menthol in them is going to make it appealing and attractive to young people. And so you have to go ahead and keep that same ban across the board, menthol, flavored e-cigarettes as well. And so the FDA, in my opinion, should strengthen that ban that they're having, should strengthen those restrictions on the e-cigarettes and include menthol and flavors as well.
Now, looking in the long haul, Del Monte, what are you seeing when it comes to the rates of smoking for African Americans? Are we making some headway here?
We are making some headway. Yes, we are. And we're going to make even more headway as long as, again, we don't simply depend and say that the FDA is going to solve all of our problems. This problem will be solved if we, at the local level, with communities, take ownership and ban the sale of mentholated tobacco products, whether they're tobacco, whether they're e-cigarettes or whatever. If communities take ownership and pass these types of restrictions, I think that we're going to see even greater progress.
Right. This FDA ban, if it happened, this is at least a couple of years away. Are you seeing, you know, as you said, it started in Chicago, then spread to other communities, are you seeing growing interest from cities and other local governments in this idea of restricting access to menthol cigarettes?
Absolutely. That has grown. Again, with Chicago being the first back in 2013, we've seen a steady progression. I think that what the FDA put out last week in terms of their proposal to ban menthol, I am hopeful that that will strengthen this movement even further to say, hey, yeah, you can go ahead and ban menthol if you'd like, ban menthol and tobacco products. But we as communities now that you've acknowledged, FDA, that it's a problem, we're going to take ownership of this ourselves, and we're going to ban and restrict the sale of mentholated tobacco products in our communities. That's the ownership that we're looking for.
And have you seen legal challenges to these local bans?
Absolutely. Matter of fact, Chicago's ban was challenged twice and won in both cases. And so once it was won, in the courts, then we knew that we had a winner because it was challenged. We had precedent that it could last, that cities and local jurisdictions did have the authority legally and within the courts to challenge and to uphold this ban. And so this is something that has been tested. It has been proven. And again, it's a movement that's taking place.
And one thing we haven't touched on, the FDA also about banning flavored cigar products, sweetened cigars, again, saying there may be a starting tobacco use for minors. Is that something you were hoping for?
Well, absolutely. Again, we wanted this to be inclusive, all-inclusive, back in 2009. And even back in 2016, when the FDA tried to exercise this authority over e-cigarettes and cigars, we were very hopeful at that point in time. And everything was looking good that they were going to have that authority over the cigars until it got to the Office of Management and Budget, and then all that language that gave them that authority was stripped from the documents. And so, we're hopeful, again, that they move in this direction. But we're confident that even if they don't, we're still going to gather this and control this at the local level.
Del Monte, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Rod. I appreciate the opportunity.
That's Del Monte Jefferson. He's executive director of the National African American Tobacco Prevention Network. We talked to them today about the FDA's proposal that would, if approved, ban menthol tobacco products along with sweetened cigar products and have restrictions on some flavored e-cigarettes as well, requiring them to be in separate 18 and up rooms or in 18 and up stores only. That does exclude, as he was mentioning there, as I understand it, menthol flavored e-cigarette products. Coming up after the news, reduce, reuse, reimagine. Our guest says we need to rethink our approach to recycling, and that starts with the ways we make and buy stuff in the first place. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around, there's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the CDC is out with new figures that show no real decrease in the American infant mortality rate since 2011. We'll talk about some of the reasons why and what the problem looks like here in Wisconsin. First, you might not think too much about the things you recycle after you drag them to the curb or haul them to the local collection point. Turns out recycling is not only important for the environment, it's a $100+ billion industry that employs 500,000 people in the U.S. And many manufacturers rely on access to recycled materials to produce high quality and affordable goods. But our next guest says the U.S. lags behind many other countries in our recycling rates, and the industry as a whole is in some trouble. Beth Porter is Green America's Climate and Recycling Director. Beth creates content and resources to help people waste less stuff and improve their recycling habits. Her new book is Reduce, Reuse, Reimagine, Sorting Out the Recycling System. Beth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, how do we compare to other developed countries, Beth, when it comes to recycling in the United States?
So recycling in the United States is really at a crossroads right now. We've invested a lot in the last few decades to get enthusiasm up, which I would say was very successful. People love to recycle. They love to talk about how much they recycle. But unfortunately, that hasn't been reflected in our overall recycling rate. And I think a lot of that is from confusion, from not understanding our recycling rules of what can and can't be recycled. I think a lot of folks have the question of why? Why are we recycling? Where does it go? So I wanted to try and clear up that confusion to help us increase our recycling rates to what other developed nations are seeing, like, you know, Germany, even Taiwan are at 60% recycling rates, whereas we're hovering at 34%, where we've been stuck for about the last 20 years.
Let's tackle those questions you just brought up. Why do we want to recycle?
Recycling has high environmental benefits and also benefits to communities. So a lot of folks think that we need to recycle to reduce landfill space, which is absolutely true. But we really also need to close that loop. We need to have recycled materials that reduce our need to do mining and deforestation activities and other extraction methods that results in lower greenhouse gas emissions that are climate change causing emissions, and reducing our overall impact and pressure on the natural resources we have. So we want to be able to have recovered materials rather than needing to extract new materials, which is so much more intensive of a process. And it's also better for communities. More recycling means less incineration and landfilling, which has been burdened disproportionately by certain communities, largely communities of color, lower-income communities. So recycling has been another process to urge and push forward as a solution so that we don't have to rely so much on these more linear disposal methods that don't have as much benefit for the environment and can negatively impact communities.
And as far as where it goes and what is done with it, I want to get into, you talk about two different ideas of recycling. One where we separate out everything into separate bins, and then the other one, I think it's called single stream, where we just put all recyclables in one place. That has its advantages. We don't have a lot of bins and a lot of sorting, but it causes certain problems with the stuff we're hoping to recycle. What happens?
Absolutely. So single stream has become the most common recycling method for our curbside recycling programs. And exactly as you said, it's all in one bin. It requires no sorting on the part of the resident. And that has resulted in more participation because it's easier for folks to participate, which is great. But it's also resulted in high contamination. So we have issues with folks putting in things that are coated in food or beverage. So that's sort of like a cleanliness issue of our recyclables. But when you've got, you know, an orange juice container with a little bit of liquid left and you put it in with your magazines, that single stream all-in-one bin can lead for that orange juice to get to your magazine and saturate it and degrade the quality and marketability of that fiber. So single stream has resulted in the increase in contamination and the lower quality recyclables that are having a really tough time in the market right now.
Talking to Beth Porter from Green America, her new book is called Reduce, Reuse, Reimagine, Sorting Out the Recycling System. A lot of your suggestions for our recycling system, Beth, take place way before we have that item hovering over the bin and trying to figure out if I should put it in or not. And I want to go back there and that it's the three-part thing, the reduce, reuse, recycle. Let's talk about the reduce part where we just use less stuff in the first place.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think we really missed out on helping people understand. You know, we wanted to spread reduce, reuse, recycle everywhere, but it's actually a hierarchy. And so we should all be looking for ways to reduce our waste first. And of course, then reuse what we already have creatively, repair those items. And the actual last resort is recycling responsibly. So focusing on the reduce aspect is something we should be trying to do in our homes, but also what I urge producing companies, retailers to do is look for ways that they can reduce their waste as well, which is really a very important key here because recycling, for all of its wonderful benefits and real measurable benefits, it doesn't erase the fact that we have a product that was produced and made that we've used, and that impact is still there. You know, recycling doesn't negate that. So focusing on the reduce and reuse, that's why those come first.
I've seen arguments that at the point of manufacturing, we should be thinking about recycling so that, and I've heard things like appliances or furniture, even buildings, building things, creating these things in a way that when their life is over, it's easier to sort out the components and recycle them or reuse them.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. What I think is a big challenge in our recycling system right now is the lack of communication in some cases between producers and recyclers. So you've got producers making products or different goods that aren't always designed for recyclability. Or even if they are designed for recyclability, some places, it might not work for the vast majority of the United States recycling program. So it's about creating products that not only have recycled content in them so that we're closing that loop, but that are also able to be responsibly recycled in communities across the U.S. And that's something that I think producers can be, should be doing a lot more of.
And you also offer a lot of concrete suggestions for people who use stuff, all of us, in that reduce a waste side. What kind of things do you recommend people think about to prevent, you know, to find the stuff they're throwing away or recycling and maybe just opt out of it?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a chapter in the book on the psychology of consumption and recycling, and I think we can do a lot to change our mental habits about how we consume resources and goods, because sometimes it's very automatic. You know, there's not a pause in that, you know, when we're being handed a receipt or a plastic straw, for example, or something like that. So creating more of those sort of disruptions in our daily habits is a really powerful, important step to be able to see what we're using. You know, a good first step is actually looking in our garbage can and our recycling bin, see what we're actually throwing out, and starting from there and think, okay, well, what's something that I could try and find a zero waste option for, or something that I could use to take my own jars and containers to the grocery store? Maybe I don't need that plastic bag for my broccoli and I can take my own reusable produce bag. So a lot of little kind of small 1 degree shifts that we can do in our daily lives, and just looking for those opportunities is the first step, starting to be aware of what we're consuming and the waste that we have. I think that we can often get very overwhelmed, at least I do, and I think many other people do too, about the amount of waste and consumption that we have right now, particularly in this country. But it's important to look and see what's within our control. You know, what are we throwing out in our house, and start from there with a tangible plan to try and reduce those items straight at our home.
A lot of the suggestions you make involve kind of mindset shifts, which seems hard to pull off, but you actually give a little history of recycling from the 20s through the 50s, where we went from, scrap metal and waste people, that's kind of un-American, buy new stuff. Then World War II, where recycling was this most patriotic thing imaginable. And then back to the 50s when we were, you know, flinging our plastic plates out into the lawn, basically. We can turn on a dime here, it seems like.
Yeah, we definitely have a history of shifting back and forth. And I think, you know, with the war effort, it was really a fascinating time because you saw the scrap drives, you saw the victory gardens, and people really looking for ways to reduce waste. But we're talking about a long term here. That was a certain time period. You know, there was an end date once the war was done. There's kind of, you know, the prosperity around the corner, that hopefulness was there. But what I hope that we can do now is a fundamental transformation, really, with how we use resources and how we discard them. And I think this year we've seen a huge amount of awareness that's been raised through the concerns with ocean plastic pollution and, of course, the straw phenomenon, which has surprised many environmentalists, including myself, of the popularity of how fast that movement grew. But that's an opportunity. That's a door to open and discuss how we're using waste in other ways and try and achieve that spillover behavior where we think, okay, well, now people are really thinking about the straws. We also want people to think about the cups that's coming in or the paper bag they're using, and seeing that larger chain from the decisions we make and the decisions that producers make in making these items, and how that all leads back to the environment and impacted communities.
Beth Porter is with us, Green America's Climate and Recycling Director. Her new book is called Reduce, Reuse, Reimagine, Sorting Out the Recycling System. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you put a lot of thought into recycling? Do you try to recycle stuff as much as you can? Do you get confused by the system sometimes? A lot of people do. I do. Do you try to reduce the amount of things you consume or reuse what you can? And what does your recycling system look like in your part of the state, your part of the country? Call in at 800-642-1234. And by the way, if you work in recycling yourself or a business that relies on recycled goods, love to hear from you. 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Beth Porter. Her new book is Reduce, Reuse, Reimagine, Sorting Out the Recycling System. You can call in at 800-642-1234. You can tell us about what recycling is like in your community. Do you find it easy to do? Do you have questions about where it all goes? Call 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Kenneth is with us in Janesville. Kenneth, hi.
Hello. Since the 1st of January, China has refused to buy any reused newspaper. And where is all this these millions of tons of used newspaper have been going since then.
Kenneth, thanks. Tell us about the China connection and all this, Beth.
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you, Kenneth. So just a bit of backstory that in the past, for the past few decades, we've been exporting about one-third of our recyclables. Half of that has been going to China. And yet, exactly as Kenneth said, this year, China has put forth a policy that bans our recycled materials and has put forth a very strict contamination rate of 0.5%. Previously, the bales we were sending may have had 5% contamination. So it's a pretty big turnaround. But now what we're seeing is really throughout the industry, folks are trying to find new end buyers in those new end markets. And some of those have been overseas and other parts of Asia. And also looking back towards domestic companies. And that's what they're striving for right now, is to find new end buyers that can fill the hole that this China disruption has caused. And there's a lot of tension, there's a lot of pain in the industry right now, to be perfectly honest, of trying to navigate this huge disruption. But there's also a lot of optimism. People are very hopeful and optimistic that this is going to be a huge transformation for our recycling system. And instead of relying on China to be buying our flawed items, there's a lot more emphasis going into education and cleaning up the supply of recyclables so that they're more appealing and will be purchased by domestic companies. And so that's where we're seeing, you know, the effects of China right now. And of course, it's still happening. There's still a lot of transition that's going on. Some communities are actually moving from single stream back to dual stream or multi-stream, where we see lower contamination rates there. But right now, that's the goal, is to find new end buyers for this material. So, that's unfortunately where we're at. Kenneth, fortunately and unfortunately, I guess I could say.
Kenneth, thanks for the call. Going out to Lydia in Richmond, Illinois. Lydia, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, Lydia?
My question is about, my service does only offer, you know, all your recyclables in one bin. And I just wanted to know if you had any advice as to what I could do to make those recyclables more useful, or if there's another avenue I should take outside of that service to make sure my recyclables are being put into the right places.
That's a great question. Yeah, we're saying clean, empty, and dry. You know, these are the things we should be striving for with our recyclables. So we don't have to clean our recyclables perfectly. They don't need to look brand new, but they shouldn't be dripping with food or beverage. That's a big one. And another huge piece is just knowing what is your local recycling rules and what your local facility accepts and doesn't accept, and sticking with those rules. And if you have a question about that, a great resource is Earth 911. You can go and enter in any item that you're trying to recycle in your zip code, and they'll advise for the best steps for how you can recycle it. Because sometimes an item might not be recyclable in your single stream curbside program, but there might be a drop-off location near you where you can take that item, so you can still make sure it's getting in the recycling stream. And making sure that things are emptied out and not contaminated with food is a big one. That's really huge. So if you make sure to do that, that's actually a big difference and very helpful in ensuring that contamination is down, the quality of your recyclables up, and that makes them more marketable.
Lydia, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Beth Porter. Her new book is Reduce, Reuse, Reimagine. Back to your calls now. Mark is on the line in Bloomer. Mark, hello.
Hey there, friend. My wife and I, due to my job, have been moving all over the state of Wisconsin, primarily northeast Wisconsin and northwest Wisconsin, and we've chosen to live mostly rural. And we're willing to drive our recycling into the local recycling center, but I know the majority of my rural neighbors, they will not. You can put your trash to the curb, but you cannot put your recycling to the curb, and you know where they're going to put their recycling. They're not driving it into town.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. And in a lot of rural places around the country, Beth, I imagine there's not that curbside pickup. Are there community efforts to say, okay, we'll get everybody in this square mile or so together and try to work together to cart the stuff over?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a great point. And I mean, throughout recycling's history, we've seen community come together and fill that need where there weren't recycling pickup options. And sometimes it was a great example is Recycle Here, I believe in Detroit. And they just put out a sign and said, Recycle Here. And once a month, people brought their recyclables and a few community members were willing to truck the recyclables in. And it really helped for the community members to have that centralized space. I believe also this was shared in schools, so kids go home and say, we have to recycle, and got the parents to make sure they were dropping off their recyclables at this kind of informal drop-off station, really. So there are those kinds of grassroots efforts that I think are great and really inspiring that people do. I guess I would also ask of your neighbors, you know, what's the barrier for them? Is it just that there's not a curbside service? And is there some sort of like community effort that can show the demand for a curbside service? This doesn't have to be a community run initiative that operates in perpetuity, of course, unless someone wants to do that. But just to show that there's a demand out there for recycling in this part of your county, that can be a huge indicator to a local government that they need to expand their recycling services because they're going to be getting materials from it and that folks want it to be there. So there are different ways to express demand. We need to express demand, of course, in the purchases we make to try and buy recycled content items, but we can also express demand for better recycling services, more transparency from our local government. Town hall meetings are a great way to do that. Going and expressing that you need expanded service. Not everyone has access to this. We want recycling to be accessible for everyone. And if the barriers are logistical, keeping someone from participating rather than ideological, that's a great question to ask and start from there to see how much interest there is in your community in recycling if that opportunity were there.
Thanks for calling in and sharing your story. Gary is with us now in Decorah, Iowa. Gary, hi. What did you want to bring up?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This has been great too, by the way, but most of this has been front-end oriented is how I would word it, and I'm kind of wondering, are there new technologies coming down the pike as far as the processing of our recyclables to make that maybe not necessarily energy efficient, but more profitable, lower those costs, and make it more usable for most people? So I'll hang up, and thanks again for this.
High-tech sorting of our recyclables, Beth.
That is a wonderful question. That's definitely one of the solutions that folks in the industry are striving for right now is more increased efficient sorting machinery. So there are companies that provide the machines that sort a lot of our recyclables, particularly in these single stream programs. The end result is a MRF. That's a material recovery facility. And those buildings hold giant sophisticated machines that are able to separate out our paper fibers from our plastics and then each kinds of plastic and using giant magnets for metals. I mean, they're really cool, honestly. If you live near a MRF, I highly recommend anyone go and take a tour of these facilities because they're fascinating. But there's constantly research and striving for innovation to make these machines improved in efficiency and also the sophistication of them to make sure that they're able to catch all of the very different materials we're seeing entering the stream, all the different plastics and things of that nature. Now, the one challenge is that this requires investments, obviously. So the MRF needs to be able to improve their machines and adapt to this, you know, kind of cutting edge technology to make sure that their sorting capabilities are matching that. So I think we're going to be seeing, hopefully, more and more investment in recycling infrastructure to make sure that we're able to sort and process these materials efficiently and effectively.
Thanks for that call. And Beth, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. This is great. I loved having all the questions. And folks can reach out at bethrecycles.com if they have more questions. I love to talk about this stuff.
Wonderful.
So thank you.
Thanks so much. And thanks for all your calls. Beth Porter is Green America's Climate and Recycling Director. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Reduce, Reuse, Reimagine, Sorting Out the Recycling System. There is still time for you to share your stories. You can tweet us at Central Time or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. what is recycling like in your community? Is there something that confuses you or is maybe a barrier that keeps you from recycling or something that you think works really well and you're glad it works that way? Or if you work in a business that is directly involved in recycling or relies on recycled products, tell us your story on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Last week on the show, we got two perspectives on the Thanksgiving Day question, turkey or not turkey. Since then, we got some more responses on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Daniel says, I like to experiment with new recipes, but for Thanksgiving, my family demands only the classics. Turkey, whole cranberry sauce, mashed potatoes, gravy, green beans, and rolls, followed up by pumpkin pie, of course. A different Daniel says, wild turkey pot pie, Hubbard squash, wild plum jam, and balsamic sauce. Also, the polling experts at 538.com asked their audience about Thanksgiving preferences, and they found some regional trends around the country. Turkey was the strong favorite main dish wherever you go. No surprise there. But they also looked for the most disproportionately favored side dishes in different parts of the country. So, like, you're going to see these side dishes overrepresented. We in Wisconsin are in this Midwestern biscuit or roll zone. We are more prone to put that little lump of bread on the table. I shall be doing that this Thursday myself. They are not homemade. Just to our west, starting in Minnesota, green beans and green bean casserole get really big. I'll be serving non-casseroled green beans. And for pie, pumpkin, again, no surprise, the national favorite. For second choice, again, it varies around the country. I think in the south, pecan pie, yum. That's pretty good. Apple pie in the northeast. Here, we are cherry pie people, apparently, according to these survey respondents. That I won't have, I don't think. Let us know your favorite pie. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.